From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The president's Twitter feed today includes demands to unmask the whistleblower, claims that the allegations against him are, quote, another Democrat hoax, and a map of all the counties he won in 2016 emblazoned with the words, quote, try to impeach this. Nevertheless, the wheels of the impeachment inquiry are turning. So this hour On Point, the latest from Washington. We'll also take a deep dive into the Ukrainian side of this story, and we'll talk to the former Inspector General of the NSA on how the intelligence community is handling this moment. And you can join us. Do you fully understand the Ukrainian side of this story? What was going on in that country's politics that has now landed in the center of a Washington impeachment inquiry? What's your question about that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we begin today in Washington with Jeanine Santucci. She is Politics Now reporter for USA Today. Jeanine, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, a lot to discuss just in the past 24 hours. Let's just begin with the several House committees subpoenaing or issuing a subpoena for the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Can you tell us more about that?
Right. So it's been a week since the impeachment inquiry was announced. And since then, the House Democrats have been moving. Nancy Pelosi says she wants to make this as expeditious as possible. So with that, we've seen a string of depositions scheduled and subpoenas, including Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, as you mentioned, and also including Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. And so the point of this is to sort of look into further what the State Department's role exactly was in all of this Ukraine business. Rudy Giuliani has been at the center of a lot of these claims. He has espoused some of the unsubstantiated claims about the Bidens and about the 2016 election. So what exactly was his role in communicating with Ukraine and asking Ukraine in these investigations?
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later in the show, but you also mentioned the State Department there. So let's discuss a little bit more about, again, a recent revelation being reported by several news outlets that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on that call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. Now, I mean, that it's not entirely unusual for a secretary of state to be on a call between the president and another head of state.
Right. So this is news that came out yesterday. Mike Pompeo, his name never appears in the anonymous whistleblower complaint. However, it has been reported. Sources are saying that Mike Pompeo was one of the officials listening in on the call, which isn't unusual, as you've mentioned. Many different officials have been listening in on these calls. The whistleblower complaint names at least one or two other State Department officials who were on the call, according to the whistleblower. And the question here that we're looking at is, how much did Mike Pompeo know? How much was he involved in the questions that President Trump had been asking to Ukraine? So as I said, Pompeo has been subpoenaed. He has until this Friday to release documentation related to State Department Rudy Giuliani communications with Ukraine. And so we're kind of trying to see how, if this is an indication as to how much the White House and Trump administration officials will be cooperating in this impeachment inquiry.
And we should also note that it's being reported that Attorney General Bill Barr, this was again news from last night, it seems like every few hours there's another story that comes out, but that Attorney General Bill Barr had asked the president to reach out to heads of state in several countries, and B, had been meeting with members or representatives from other countries to gather their support for the Justice Department's inquiry into the Mueller report. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Jeanine?
Yeah. So what we know so far is that the president has been in touch with foreign leaders. We know that Australia was involved, but it's not clear at this point how many other countries he had been in touch with. And that was to seek the aid the aid of multiple countries to help with this Attorney General Barr inquiry into the Mueller-Russia probe, which, of course, was investigating Russian interference into the 2016 election. This is something that Donald Trump has repeatedly called a witch hunt, one of the greatest witch hunts against a president. And the New York Times came out with this report yesterday, sort of, and according to their sources, suggesting similarities in the way that these particular communications were handled to the Ukraine whistleblower communications. So according to their sources, there were efforts made by the White House to sort of block some certain officials from being able to see those records. So that's the comparison being drawn here. But again, this is an entirely new development. We don't know a whole lot about it yet. And it goes back to another story about the president, which is the Mueller report.
Well, and the Australian media last night reporting that the Australian ambassador back in May, in late May, had sent a letter to the Attorney General saying that the Australian government will use its best endeavors to support your efforts in this matter. So interesting. So Janine, I mean, do you have any sense as to what the next steps might be, especially coming out of these House committees that are a part of this impeachment inquiry?
Yes. So Congress is actually on a scheduled 2-week recess. However, during the recess, they have planned several depositions. There are 5 State Department officials with planned depositions over the next 2 weeks. Some of those who were named in the whistleblower complaint, others who may have key stakeholding interests into relations between the United States and Ukraine. In addition to that, the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community is set to appear before Congress. And all of this, I should note, will be closed door. It won't be publicly broadcasted testimony. Adam Schiff, who is the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has also indicated that the whistleblower will be speaking before Congress sometime very soon, is what he said.
Well, Janine Santucci, she covers Politics Now, or she is the Politics Now reporter for USA Today, speaking to us from Washington. Janine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna.
Okay, well, let's turn now to Evelyn Farkas. She's a resident senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and she served from 2012 to 2015 as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Evelyn Farkas, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna.
So we want to take a deep dive with you into Ukraine and how it finds itself at the center or near the center of this impeachment storm in Washington. So first of all, I mean, just give us your big picture take here. Are you surprised at all that Ukraine is such a central figure here right now?
Well, unfortunately, Magna, I've started to think that the origin of the idea that somehow Ukraine is complicit in any of this has come from the Kremlin, which is to say that, of course, we know that President Trump found out, because it was not widely known. I was in government at the time and did not know that Vice President Biden's son had a business relationship with a company in Ukraine at the time that the vice president was the vice president. But President Trump discovered this and then created a kind of scandal story. Now, whether it's appropriate or not for the president, the vice president's son to be doing business in another country is a separate question, you know, using his name because he doesn't have any other real reason to be on the board of this oil company. Mm-hmm. Again, separate question. The real problem is that President Trump manufactured a scandal and asked Rudy Giuliani to look into getting some kind of evidence for this scandal out of the Ukrainians, who are very vulnerable to all kinds of pressure from the United States government. But not only did he do that, but then he got on the phone with the Ukrainian president and essentially used the pressure of pending U.S. military assistance for a hot war the Ukrainians are mm-hmm. fighting in eastern Ukraine to get the president of Ukraine to agree to help him dig up dirt on the Bidens to come up with some kind of fabricated story. And the president, of course, who knows what he was thinking in his head, but he had very little choice. And the fact of the matter is that this call would have been a secret. So it would have been something that our president and, in fact, the United States could have been blackmailed on by the Ukrainian government. But a whistleblower came and told the world about this story.
So, Evelyn, let me just jump in here because I want to peel away. We're going to peel these layers back here. But you started your answer by saying that you fear that this is something that has been manufactured by the Kremlin? I mean, specifically meaning what?
Well, what I mean by this is that when the president in that phone call asked for dirt on the Bidens, he also mentioned a missing server that CrowdStrike had, that somehow it could be in Ukraine. I mean, literally something he pulled out of thin air, except that I've been told that it's kind of swirling around in these right-wing conspiracy theory websites, which we know the Russians are very heavily enmeshed in. And ultimately, who does this serve? It serves the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin. This whole story, and impeachment for that matter, serves the Russian government, because they would love for the whole Russia investigation, the idea that Russia, we know Russia interfered in our elections, but the Russians would like to debunk the truth of that and pin it on Ukraine, ideally, because then they will be out of the clear, out in the clear, and Ukraine will be seen as the bad guy. And so we will lift sanctions on Russia and no longer help Ukraine.
Evelyn, we have to take a break in just a second here, but I want to be clear on something. Are you saying that you wonder if the Kremlin is directly involved or indirectly through their misinformation campaigns?
I don't know, Meghna. I don't have evidence for this. Indirectly, certainly, it's swirling out there. Directly, I think, is a bit harder for me, sitting where I am in Washington, D.C., to prove.
Okay, well, when we come back, we'll take a deep dive into what's happening in Ukraine, or the things that have happened in Ukraine over the past couple of years that have led to this moment. So Evelyn Farkas, stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're joined today by Evelyn Farkas. She's a resident senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and she served from 2012 to 2015 as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. And a little later this hour, we will also hear from the former Inspector General from the National Security Agency as well, about whistleblower protection in the intelligence community. But with Evelyn, we are talking about Ukraine and how it finds itself at the center of this Washington impeachment storm. And as folks might recall, part of what the president has been claiming, part of what he communicated with the president of Ukraine in that phone call from July was the notion that Vice President Joe Biden had pressured the Ukrainian government to fire a prosecutor named Viktor Shokin in order to protect his son, Hunter Biden. That's the claim that the White House is making. Now, Ukraine's former foreign minister, Pavlo Klimkin, spoke to the BBC last week and flatly rejected that notion.
It was a real drive from the whole international community, not just Biden, not just US, but also from the European Union, but also international financial institutions. I remember it quite well.
Evelyn Farkas, I want to take a step back here because this risks becoming very muddied very quickly. And I want to lean on your experience here because you were Deputy Assistant Secretary from 2012 to 2015. And towards the end of that time, if I remember correctly, Jeffrey Pyatt, right, who had been the American ambassador to Ukraine, was speaking out very clearly about Ukrainian corruption. So what was the United States' position at that time about corruption in Ukraine?
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, I mean, I remember it clearly as well. And I agree with former Foreign Minister Klimkin. The way that it worked out was, you know, if you go back just very quickly, if you'll humor me a little, Magna.
Sure.
You know, they got rid of the old Russian-backed crony government in Ukraine. The people went to the streets. He shot 100 people. He lost his nerve, even though we had brokered an interim transition government. But he lost his nerve. He fled to Russia. The Russian government reaction was to invade Ukraine and seize Crimea. The Ukrainians held elections. A new government came in. This guy, Petro Poroshenko, you might remember him. Mm-hmm. He was an oligarch. He was kind of a he was a leader. He was clearly wanted to root out corruption, or said he wanted to, but he was dragging his heels. And so we in the government said we got to tell him his prosecutor general is not doing enough. And we started to identify the prosecutor general as a real problem. I mean, maybe Poroshenko was the problem, but certainly the prosecutor general. So there were all kinds of hints, you know, that the prosecutor general had to go, and the IMF was in on it, the European Union. We were all agreed in our interagency meetings. And President Biden, Vice President Biden was the point of contact very often with President Poroshenko. So he would bring up our grievances and bring up our concerns about this guy not fighting corruption. Because remember, the whole world is sending money to Ukraine, trying to help Ukraine fight the war and also clean up corruption and get its economic house in order, right? So we don't want our money going into a corrupt system. So Vice President Biden basically executed President Obama's policy. That's it. Mm. And of course, what happened later was, even though they got rid of that prosecutor general, the next guy was maybe better, but still not great. And ultimately, the Ukrainian people said, okay, forget it. We want this young guy who's never been in politics before to be our president. And that's the current president now.
So given all that, though, I mean, that's the background here. I do have to ask you, wasn't it more than a little unseemly that the vice president's son was sitting on the board of a company that was run by Mykola Zlochevsky, who was under investigation by foreign governments, in fact, for corruption?
Yeah. So I don't want to split hairs, because I think the larger point that you make, that, you know, people who are related to people of power in the U.S. government should be very careful about what kind of business dealings they make. They should really, I always say, you know, the Washington Post test. If you read it in the Washington Post on the front page, would it look okay? So in this case, I don't think it looks okay, because Hunter Biden doesn't have a background in oil and gas. He doesn't have a background in Eastern Europe and Ukraine. So really, it looks like he was put on that board because his father's the vice president, and the father understands Eastern Europe. Having said that, the head of Burisma, the company in question, had been investigated by the Poroshenko government, and they dropped the investigation. So we don't know if that means that there was nothing there, or if indeed, again, this just adds to the issue where Poroshenko's inspector general, this guy Shokin, was not aggressive enough about corruption. So if anything, Vice President Biden was actually potentially harming the interests of this company that his son was sitting on the board of.
Right. So because if further investigation had taken place
under a new prosecutor general, right?
Correct.
Which didn't happen. So again, that leaves the impression that there was nothing to see there. Who knows? But really, that's up to the Ukrainian government. And Hunter Biden sitting on the board of this company, that doesn't necessarily implicate him in any wrongdoing.
Okay. Well, let's listen then to CNN's Clarissa Ward, because she was in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev just recently, and she spoke with Sergei Lyshenko, a politician and former campaign aide to President Zelensky, who's, of course, the president that the Ukrainian president that that President Trump spoke to on the phone in July. And Lyshenko said that the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, had come to Ukraine asking about the Bidens.
For Giuliani, it was the only interest in Ukraine to get this information about Biden and to use this information in U.S.
You think that he was focused on it for the president, or?
No, for sure, not for his private purposes. We know who is Giuliani. We know what is his role. We know that he is acting not just a private person, but on behalf of his client.
So this wasn't a secret.
It was a clear fact.
That's CNN's Clarissa Ward speaking to Sergei Lyshenko, a former campaign aide to Ukrainian President Zelensky. Evelyn Farkas, what do you make of that?
So that's bad enough, right? I mean, we now know from the Ukrainian side, and we also knew from Rudy Giuliani himself, because he was already talking months ago about going to Ukraine and trying to find out information about, you know, Hunter Biden and Vice President Biden. So we already knew that. What makes it worse is that the president directed it, because we have it on tape. We have it, or not on tape, but we have it from that memorandum that the staff made and then hid away in the secret computer in the White House. So again, it's the personal lawyer of the president trying to dig up dirt, trying to get a foreign country, in essence, to get involved in our elections. But I think what Giuliani was doing was on the edge of criminal. What Trump was doing, what President Trump was doing, asking the government to get involved directly, that's definitely criminal. So Rudy Giuliani cherry picking information from overseas, I think that's probably not necessarily criminal. I leave it to lawyers to decide that. But the president asking under pressure, you know, extorting out of the Ukrainian government because they have no choice because they rely on us for military assistance, extorting from them help in his campaign, that is clearly illegal.
Well, the president himself has pointed to the fact that President Zelensky says that that is not what he felt happened in that phone call here. I just want to play the moment that President Trump refers to, because during the UN General Assembly in New York last week, they sat side by side. And President Zelensky told reporters that he does not feel he was coerced by President Trump during that famous phone call.
It was normal. We spoke about many things. And so I think, and you read it, that nobody pushed me. Yes.
In other words, no pressure.
President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky at the UN General Assembly last week. Now, Evelyn Farkas, they were sitting side by side, so I'm
exactly.
Yeah, but tell us more about
I mean,
what you hear
that,
in Zelensky.
If your boss, the guy that you rely on, you know, to keep the lights on, if you will, because in essence, the military assistance we provide to Ukraine is critical to them deterring Russia from taking more territory and important for them to maintain some kind of strength at the negotiating table. So again, this guy has no choice. He's sitting there next to President Trump. Of course, he's going to say, I don't feel pressured. Mm. You would, too, if your boss led you as a witness that way.
Well, I'm speaking with Evelyn Farkas. She's resident senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. And from 2012 to 2015, she was deputy assistant secretary of defense for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia. And we want to know what your question is about the Ukrainian side of this story. Let's go to Lee, who's calling from Delavan, Wisconsin. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi. So I have a question. Trump gets elected with Russian help in our interference in our election process. Trump meets in secret with the Russian president with no transparency, no disclosure. Now, Ukraine is drawn into this impeachment process as what appears to be a scapegoat because of, again, Trump's undoing. My question is, where is the transparency? It seems to be that this little breadcrumb trail of Trump getting elected by the Russians' help, Trump meeting with the Russian presidents with no transparency. He's not telling the American people what he talked about or what's going on. And now he's got Ukraine drawn into this. Where's the transparency with that breadcrumb trail with our own country and our own State Department? It just seems a bit odd.
Mm. Lee, thank you for your call. Evelyn, do you have a response for him?
Yeah, I do. First of all, Lee, thank you for that point, because even if you are a hardcore President Trump supporter and you don't want to believe that he welcomed Russian interference or that he's now soliciting Ukrainian interference, one thing I think we should all agree on is that our government should provide us, the American people, information about these phone calls, about these meetings that they are conducting on our behalf. And this White House has been highly unusual. You can ask all the Republicans who have served in previous administrations about their treatment of these meetings. First of all, sometimes they've failed to even notify the press, and then through the press, the public, about some of these meetings. The famous meeting where President Trump met with the foreign minister of Russia and the Russian ambassador in the White House was actually not notified to our press. The Russian press was in the room, which is also probably a counterintelligence problem. And they were the ones that told the American people. They have refused to provide transcripts. The Russians, most often, we see them giving what we call a readout, a summary of a phone call or of a meeting. I mean, which is, of course, one-sided and, you know, can leave us open to some kind of blackmail from the Russians. And then, of course, we know that the president told an interpreter when he met with the Russian president for about 2 hours in, I believe it was Germany, he told the interpreter to not tell anyone and to throw away their notes. Helsinki, we saw how the president behaved with the Russian president, basically publicly saying he believed the Russian president over his own U.S. intelligence officials who were neutral, non-political experts. So, yes, transparency is very, very badly needed. And this is now what Congress is doing through this impeachment process. At a minimum, we will see more about what President Trump has said to the Russian president and vice versa, and a whole host of other foreign heads of state, I believe.
Let's go to Travis, who's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Travis, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to say, what's wrong with Trump talking to the Ukrainians, asking for any information? He's a former vice president who's alleged wrongdoing, and it's just, why can't he ask? And where's the quid pro quo? He said, the Ukrainian president said from his own mouth that he wasn't pressured, so I don't understand what the big deal is.
Travis, quick question. I mean, so what would, in your mind, what would the president have had to have said to come across as actual quid pro quo to you?
Well, I mean, what's the evidence? Like, even if it's the vice president, president, secretary of state, why can't he ask for, assistance? And there's also a treaty, I'm sure you're aware of, that we are linked or allowed to share information about prosecutorial matters and such. So,
I'm going to turn your question to Evelyn Farkas, and I really appreciate you calling in. But I mean, the law does state that foreign interference in U.S. elections in a campaign is not legal. So if the president is asking for assistance regarding his campaign, regarding the election, that is problematic, to say the least. Do you agree?
He's asking for assistance to get to the bottom of the wrongdoing of Joe Biden. What is that? It just so happens he's running for president. What if he wasn't? Would it still be a quid pro quo?
Good question. So let me turn that to Evelyn Farkas. Travis, thank you for your call. Evelyn, how would you respond to him?
So Travis is asking a good question. I think you have to understand the law, right? So if President Trump were asking about any other U.S. citizen, it would be highly unusual. I think if it weren't his candidate running against him, a declared political opponent, maybe it wouldn't be a problem. But in this case, he is a declared candidate for the presidency, and we know our president is a declared candidate to be reelected. And so this would be asking for foreign assistance and interference in our elections, and that is absolutely against the law. If let's say Travis's uncle did something wrong and President Trump wanted to call the Ukrainian president and ask for his cooperation in helping dig out the wrongdoing of Travis's uncle, then that would probably be legal. But again, that would be something that the FBI would discuss with their Ukrainian law enforcement counterparts. So it's also unusual from that perspective.
Hmm. Well, Evelyn, let me ask you to take it back to where we started, because you brought up Russia and its potential role in this moment that we find ourselves in now. I believe a Kremlin spokesperson a couple of days ago said that Moscow does not want, if this were to happen, Moscow does not want transcripts of conversations between the president, President Trump, and Russian President Vladimir Putin released. I mean, could Russia actually be concerned that this could all backfire?
Oh, yes. They seem quite nervous, and they very much want our president to know. That's why they publicly said, you know, don't release those things. So I'm sure that's giving quite a lot of people in the White House who, again, now we know more people than the president are aware of these conversations and are covering up for him. You know, this has got to be giving people some pause. Now, when I say covering up, the problem is it's difficult because some people don't have the power to, you know, they're covering up because they think they're helping the overall national security interest. And then there are others who are helping the president. So that's for Congress to sort out. But yes, the Russian government is probably quite nervous right now, and they should be.
Well, Evelyn Farkas is resident senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and from 2012 to 2015, she served as deputy assistant secretary of defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Evelyn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
When we come back, we'll talk to the former inspector general for the National Security Agency about how the intelligence community handles whistleblower complaints. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump continues to demand to know the identity of the whistleblower who submitted that report of urgent concern. Here's the president just yesterday.
Mr. President, do you now know who the whistleblower is, sir?
Well, we're trying to find out about a whistleblower. When you have a whistleblower that reports things that were incorrect.
That's the president yesterday. He has also previously referred to people who may have given the whistleblower information as spies. So how is this resonating within the intelligence community? Well, Joel Brenner joins us now. He served as Inspector General for the National Security Agency from 2002 to 2006. He was also head of the U.S. Counterintelligence under the Director of National Intelligence from 2006 to 2009. So served in both capacities in the administration of President George W. Bush. He's currently a senior research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. Joel Brenner, it's good to have you in the studio.
It's nice to be back.
So first of all, let me just ask you about what you make of the president's repeated demands to unmask the whistleblower.
It's another example of the president's disregard for not only basic decency, but the norms that people across the political spectrum used to observe and that ensured the stability of the country.
Mm. Did you handle whistleblower complaints during your time as the NSA IG?
Oh, certainly I did. And we had a hotline in our office that we could take complaints anonymously. We could also take complaints from people who wanted to identify themselves, and we were very careful to protect their identity.
Mm. So what effect do you think the president's demands to unmask the whistleblower might be having within the intelligence community?
I think everybody in the intelligence community is extremely nervous. The president's been attacking the community explicitly, and the president's now attacking the norms by which the Congress and the intelligence community have agreed that there ought to be a way to report wrongdoing. Hmm. This is dangerous. The president's MO is to create as much chaos and confusion on all fronts as he can. That's what he's doing here.
Given your experience, both as former Inspector General of the NSA and you were head of U.S. counterintelligence under the office of the Director of National Intelligence, I mean, what concerns you most about this moment right now?
Again, it has to do with the basic trust that people used to have in American institutions. And even as that trust diminished significantly during my lifetime, there were still basic norms that people observed, ways that they behaved. This is going to make whistleblowers more reluctant to come forward. I'm talking about whistleblowers who are not merely cranky and complaining about not getting promoted and stuff. We saw plenty of that too. But people who really saw something that they thought that really looked wrong, And this especially so since the president's now saying such nasty things about this person who everybody else says in a position to know is following the rules that one fears for that person's safety. Mm-hmm. And he's said things to, you know, we're going to start a civil war and this man ought to be dealt with as a traitor. And you know what we used to do with traitors, mm-hmm. which is, you know, hang them or shoot them. I mean, this is so beyond the pale. And of course, people are extremely nervous about it.
Mm. Well, let's take a step back here for a second. How do you judge the handling of the complaint so far? Has the handling of the complaint by the intelligence community, do you think it's been by the book?
By the book was the phrase I was going to use before you said it. Mr. Atkinson, who's the IG of the ODNI and who used to be a Justice Department official and whom I've dealt with and always found to be a very capable man and a straight shooter, handled this thing as he's supposed to. He not only took it and passed it on, he did his own investigation, which helped him, as he says yesterday, said yesterday, to corroborate much of what the whistleblower had to say. And of course, the whistleblower doesn't necessarily produce admissible evidence for a court. He produces leads for an investigation, which is what one wants. He then passed it on, as he was supposed to do under the statute, to his acting director, who was prepared to send it to the Hill. So the intelligence community has behaved perfectly. The bad behavior has come after that.
So the acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, you say he was prepared to send it to the Hill? Because that seems to be a point of contention between McGuire and members of Congress.
Well, I think attacking McGuire is both a political mistake and unfair. This is an extraordinary situation involving the president of the United States. I don't believe there has been – I'm confident there's never been a previous – example of the presidents being involved in a whistleblower attack. So and it involved a conversation with a foreign leader, which on its face was a privileged conversation. There has to be a way for the White House, for a White House, for a president, forget about whatever you may think about Trump, to assert that privilege. Mm-hmm. I can't say that McGuire was behaving incorrectly by telling the White House that here's the situation, assert the privilege. I think if you were going to criticize him at all, and I say if, that you would say maybe he didn't take 2 weeks for the White House to assert a privilege. He might have given them a deadline. But I might have done that. But I can't say I would have done that without being in his shoes and understanding all the situation.
Okay, so I want to walk folks through this a little bit just to lay out some of the facts to help us understand what you're saying. Because Michael Atkinson, Inspector General, as you said, to the intelligence community, he wrote this August 26th letter to Acting Director Joseph McGuire, right? And that's been made public here. So I was just looking at it yesterday. And it's in this letter that Atkinson says that in his judgment, alleged conduct by a U.S. public official to seek foreign assistance to interfere in a federal election would constitute a serious problem or a flagrant abuse. And then the letter goes on to say that the law requires that determination of credibility, right, of the whistleblower's complaint, and that that determination be made 14 calendar days from the receipt of the complaint, which is what Atkinson and his staff proceeded to do, right?
Correct.
And he determined that the complaint appeared reported an urgent concern. That's a very key phrase here, and appears credible. And then the letter closed by saying that the DNI had 7 calendar days upon receipt of this particular letter from the Inspector General to forward it to congressional committees. Now, that would have been September 2nd, but McGuire didn't provide the complaint to Congress until the 26th of September, right? Or sorry, the 25th of September, because the Justice Department, the Office of Legal Counsel there, and McGuire had determined that it wasn't of urgent concern?
McGuire did not determine that. OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel. Office of Legal Counsel, your listeners ought to know, are the lawyers' lawyers in the Justice Department. They say what the law is from the executive branch's point of view. And what they say is law within the executive branch. So McGuire didn't make that determination.
Okay.
And so he was faced with a situation where he has a certain amount of time that if it's in this category, then he shall provide it to the Congress within a certain number of days. But the OLC is telling him it's not within that category. Now, it's clear after that happened, clear in my judgment, that McGuire then played a pretty hard game inside. And at some point, he had to be playing a tough game because the White House walked backwards on what it was willing to do. Now, McGuire says he didn't offer to resign, as the Post reported, but he had to be advocating for this to happen. And it eventually did happen. And I think one ought to, before criticizing McGuire for taking this time, you got to remember, again, this is an extraordinary situation. The Congress got what it wanted. It took a few weeks longer to get it. But McGuire has steered his ship through a very narrow channel without scraping the bottom.
Right. Well, I just want to play a little moment from McGuire's testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, where he responded to questions about why the whistleblower's complaint took more than 7 days to get to Congress. And here is what McGuire said.
That was working while I was endeavoring to get the executive privilege concerns addressed so that it can then be forwarded. It was not stonewalling. I didn't receive direction from anybody. I was just trying to work through the process and the law the way it is written. I have to comply with the way the law is, not the way some people would like it to be.
That's the acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire. But Joel Brenner, let me ask you, I mean, in your capacity with your experiences having been Inspector General for the NSA, do you think that the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department was right or wrong in its determination that this wasn't a matter of urgent concern?
Well, I think the reason they reached that conclusion, and I don't agree with the conclusion, but it's a very reasoned and plausible conclusion. And it's based on the fact that the purpose of the ICIG Act is to monitor behavior within the intelligence community. And this behavior that's complained about is not within the intelligence community.
And that's one of the chief criticisms coming from the GOP.
Well, that's criticism or not, that's a fact. And that's not a crazy view of the statute by any means. Now, I took the other view because I think the Inspector General has two responsibilities under the statute, whatever its purpose is. You'll read the plain words of the statute. One is to investigate certain things within his purview, and the other is to report certain things that come to his attention, regardless of whether he investigated them or not. And I think that under that language, the obligation to report, that the statute did cover this. But as I say, that was a difference of view. I might have said in McGuire's place, look, White House, it doesn't take this long to determine whether you're going to assert executive privilege over a conversation with a foreign leader. Everybody knows you could assert that privilege if you want to. You have 24 hours. If I don't have an assertion of privilege in writing on my desk tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to the Hill. Now, I don't think that's McGuire's style. And you've got to remember that he has got what he wanted, taking a little more time than I think it should have taken, taking a couple of weeks longer than it should have taken. But the Hill got what it wanted. What it hasn't achieved is to have legal protection for the whistleblower, because although McGuire has pledged that his organization will protect that whistleblower, it is only if the act applies that he's entitled to that protection legally.
I see. Joel Brenner, I also read in Atkinson's letter to acting DNI McGuire that Atkinson writes that whistleblowers can make complaints on urgent concerns relating to flagrant abuse of violation of law or executive order, the operation of an intelligence activity, or involving classified information. And that made me think about how over the past several days we've been having this news that there may be not just the transcript, the rough transcript of the Ukrainian call on these special, highly secret servers in the White House, but possibly other information that White House lawyers have advised White House staff to put on you know, those other servers, those, I guess, code word only servers. How outside of the of normal operations is that?
Oh, out of the normal operations of the intelligence community, it's just totally, I can't say nobody's ever done it, but it is not according to Hoyle. You put things in a, let me explain first what code word means. There are three classifications only under our law: confidential, secret, top secret. You don't go higher than that. But then we have certain horizontal classifications that have to do with things that are put in compartments, or in Defense Department called special access programs. That's what this is talking about. This server was to hold information that was compartmented or sapped, as they say. This information was not. It was clearly not appropriate to put this information there. Now, the president does have the power to classify things however he wants, which means his behavior and the ordinary IC person's behavior are not the same thing. But I would say, remind people that if you do a lawful act for an unlawful purpose in the course of conspiring to cover up illegal behavior, which I think is demonstrated in the transcript itself, then that becomes illegal. That's an act in furtherance of conspiracy. And I think that's what was going on here.
Are you more than a little gobsmacked that White House lawyers are reported to have advised White House staff to do this?
Yes. I'm you know, when things go wrong, you always want to say, where were the lawyers? And if this whistleblower complaint pans out in all respects, it appears that the lawyers were actually guiding the cover-up of this information. And I think if that is true, that they've got problems under criminal law and their license to practice law are going to be challenged at some point as well.
Mm. We have just a minute to go, Joel Brenner. I want to ask you two last quick questions here. First of all, there has been some confusion in recent days about whether or not a whistleblower has to have firsthand information in a complaint. Do they?
No. No, and why would you want that to be the case? An investigator, whether it's an investigative journalist or a prosecutor or an inspector general, wants leads. You start with leads. You don't start with admissible evidence for in a courtroom, which is what firsthand information is, so it's not hearsay. You want to get information that's credible that will then guide an investigation to produce firsthand information.
Which is what the inspector general did.
Which is what he did. And so this is a complete red herring. It's not only not the case, but you wouldn't want it to be the case.
Hmm. Well, Joel Brenner is former inspector general for the NSA. He served in that position between 2002 to 2006, and then from 2006 to 2009, he was head of U.S. counterintelligence under the director of national intelligence, and he is now a senior research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. Joel Brenner, thanks as always.
You're most welcome.
And listeners, before we go today, I want to just make a quick note on a special upcoming broadcast of the show. We're hitting the road. I'll be in Columbia, South Carolina for a special On Point live show this Thursday. We'll talk with community leaders, journalists, and voters about 2020. South Carolina is going to play a very important role in the election cycle. It's the site of the first Democratic primary in the South, so we have a request for you. Go to onpointradio.org and tell us more about what you want us to cover while we're there. Again, let us know at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.